Welcome back. We are talking about how we can grow as a leader or develop ourselves as leaders so that we're more effective. You know, we've got all this stuff that makes us who we are. We've got our personality. We've got the baggage that we carry from our childhood, our families of origin. We've got our personality type. We've got all of this stuff that goes into making us who we are. But we also have capacity to grow as leaders. So in the last session, we looked at some of those ways, looking at how you use your time, looking at the variety of people you will interact with in the ministry that God has called you to. Well, today I want to talk again about ways that you can develop or grow as a leader. And the one powerful way is learning how to make decisions effectively and quickly. And you'll note here the cartoon I came across. As soon as we solve one problem, another one appears. So let's keep this problem going for as long as we can. You may feel that way if you're involved in ministry. So one thing seems to crop up after another, after another, after another. So how do you make decisions that make the problems go away, or at least address them? Sometimes it doesn't make the problem go away. But what I'm going to give you today is a process, and I'd like to attribute it. I got it from my mentor. I don't know where he got it. But it's been very helpful to me when I face a variety of situations where I have to make a decision, where I've got to decide where resources are going to go or not go, where I'm going to decide who gets raised up and who gets let go. How do you make good decisions? So, here we go. Here's the process in 6 easy steps, though you'll find that none of them are especially easy. Step one is to define the problem. What caused it? How did you get where you are? What is the situation that needs to be addressed? What are the parameters of it? How many people does it affect? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, define the problem. That's very crucial. Bill Hybels talked in one of his talks once about being on a study leave. And while he was on a study leave, he would walk every morning to a nearby Burger King, I think it was. And there he liked to study with people around. And so there he would study for part of the morning. So, but one of the things just irritated him about this Burger King was the fact that every time he opened the door, there was this screech of metal on metal. And or it was the hinge squeaking. But he said, every day, he said, for 2 months, 5 days a week, he walked into this place, and every day he said, who is the leader in this place? Who's in charge? Why haven't they addressed this problem? Well, apparently the person never even saw that it was a problem. So problems tend to come in a couple of different ways. You know, one is the problems often rise up to you as a leader. So eventually, you know, there's a problem somebody in the organization has, and all of a sudden they hand it to you. Others will be problems that you don't know you have until you invite someone to give it to you or point it out to you. In ministry, it's vitally important. In the ministry of the church, it's vitally important. In the churches I serve, one of the things we would do is do a quick walk around as staff and simply ask, what do you see here that could be a problem? Well, in one such session, we recognized that the signage was not effective. We used all inside words to define what things were and where to go with children or where to go with a middle schooler or where to go. We defined it that way. Other things did invited people to come in from outside and just be part of our ministry for a while and tell us then what their reactions were, because sometimes we couldn't see it. Couldn't see what it looked like. And so how do you define the problem? When you're aware of it, define the problem. What is it? How did it get there? How many people does it affect? Etc. And then step two is, what are all the possible answers to this problem? Now, usually there's more than one. With a squeaky door, well, the easiest one would be get somebody to oil it, right? Or get somebody to fix it. Or you can look at it, and you can have an employee look at it, and they come back and tell you, you know what? That door is really faulty. We should replace that door. That would be one of the possible answers. Or the employee could come back and say, you know what? That entrance is really one that's in the back, and you know, we're open till 2 a.m., and somebody could come in who wants to rob the place from that door, and we'd never see them until it was too late. They'd be right in front of us. And so the solution might be to board the whole place up or brick it up and close that entry down. So what are all the possible answers? Step three, what are the estimated costs of each possible answer? Now, that cost can be computed in a couple of ways. One, simply how many dollars is it going to take? Another way to examine those costs is how much people, time, and energy is it going to take? But in that situation, you'll look and say, well, you know what, a new door costs such and such, a can of oil, hey, 89 cents, and you can put oil on it. A new door is going to cost us $500. Bricking it up is going to cost us $1,500. What are the estimated costs and why? Okay, so if we brick it up and we have our people do it, that means we got to have two people that we're going to pay more than we normally do because that's what they're going to be working on, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a strange illustration, but just trying to get the point that you look at the estimated costs of each of your possible answers that you put them down. Four, what are the likely consequences of each choice? In other words, if you do this, what are the consequences? Now, the consequences have a variety of possibilities there. In the squeaky door illustration, somebody might come in and say, you know what, if I don't fix it, I guess that's always one of your choices, don't do anything. If I don't fix it, we could lose a customer here, a good customer. If we just do the oil, well, there aren't too many consequences to that one. It's just going to be quieter, and maybe people will like that better. If we replace the door, well, there aren't too many consequences of that. But if we brick it up, we could shut off people who are normally coming there, and people don't like change, and da-da-da-da-da. What are the likely consequences of each choice? Number five, step five, is how do our values apply? Now, later on, we're going to go through a process that helps identify the cultural values of the organization you're a part of, and then we're going to talk about what values have to change to live out your vision. We're going to look at all that in coming sessions. But if you've got some values as an organization, how do they apply to the situation you are facing, and then make the decision? Now, I want to go through a couple of situations that we've faced in the church I served in the last couple of years. And they were ones where we had to say, wow, what do we do here? These are problems. A leader is facing this situation. What do we do? How do we engage the followers in the solution? So here's one of the problems we had. This was on the good side. You know, this is the right kind of problem to have. What to do about our growth? The church that I was serving had grown, and so we were being pressed a little bit in the worship area. Our children's ministry was being really pressed. Our middle school ministry, we had like 50 kids crammed into a room that was designed for 12. And it was a weird room. It was an L-shaped room, so the leader was just, you know, we had levels of seats. The first level stood on the floor, the second level sat on beanbag chairs, and the third level sat on stools, high stools, bar stools. And that's the only way we could fit people in that room. And we were running out of any space for adult ministry. We wanted to engage more adults in study, and we wanted small groups to be meeting in our building because the groups were growing and they were getting too large to meet in home. So a whole bunch of stuff that went into defining that problem. What are the problems? Well, it boiled down to worship space, adult ministry, kids, children's ministry, youth ministry. What are possible answers? Well, do nothing could have been a choice, I suppose, but you know, a leader will rarely ever make that choice. And so we looked at the various options. What could we do? We could expand our present facility. If we just built a bigger facility, that would make more room for all of these things. What about creating a different venue that's very popular in the United States right now, where the preaching and a worship service will be broadcast to another venue, sometimes far away, sometimes somewhere else in the building, or sometimes to a nearby building? And then what about a daughter church? Maybe it's time for us to hive off a couple of hundred people and to say, okay, we're sending you out to begin a new church in the south area of Grand Haven, Michigan, and down in the township down there. Or what about joining another church? In fact, I had contact with some other churches in the area that were struggling and just had conversation with the pastor about what about uniting with you. And, you know, we'll take over, we'll give you a couple hundred people, and, you know, we just want to launch this as not the normal daughter church, but to join your ministry and make it grow. So all of those became possible answers. And they had various levels of complexity to them, at various levels of what staff would be needed to do it. But we looked at those possible answers, and then we began to compute the costs. If we were to do an expansion, what would that look like that would meet our needs? And so we called in some building people from the church. We did some studies and surveys about what it would cost, and it came out to be a pretty substantial number. If we were going to meet all three of those objectives, to expand youth ministry, children's ministry, children, youth, and adult ministry and worship space. It was a little over $3 million was the bottom line. And but to do another venue, we looked at that and we said, okay, we're going to have to purchase all kinds of technology, which we don't presently possess. We're going to have to hire somebody who's going to be the pastor for that venue, or we're going to have to take somebody from our church and put them there as pastor, main pastor, and what is that going to cost there? And then staffing for children's ministry, if we're going to do a venue that fits us, we got to do children's ministry well. And so we looked at all those. Looked at the same kind of things for a daughter church. Who's going to go? How will we do this? And we looked at the conversations I'd had with other pastors. So we looked at all of those and said, how much is this going to cost? In each case, it was well over $1 million. And we started talking about what are the consequences of each choice. And we went through the list. If we expand our facility, what are the consequences? Well, there's some rather large consequences to that. One would be, we've got to raise that money. And that means we're going to have to ask people to sacrifice. And that's going to be a big consequence. And usually when that happens within the church, some people leave. And that's going to be a consequence. If we do a venue, that could be interesting. But where would we do it? We contacted a couple of organizations right near us that had space available on Sunday morning. Well, which one? If we go there, we won't be able to provide any children's ministry. And so that will have an impact on it. And so that would be a cost. That who would go? It would probably be older people. Consequences. Oh, another one I forgot. We looked at adding another worship service, and that we did away with really quickly because there just wasn't time in our schedule to put it all in. Anyways, consequences. We looked at the church values. One of our deeply held values was we wanted to have an impact in our community. And we felt that we offered a unique aspect of church life in that we were going to be a place of grace, we said, where anybody could come. And we had a good relationship with a lot of organizations that would refer people to us who had had difficulty in their life. We had a shelter, a men's and women's shelter, and then family shelter they expanded into, where people had been hurt by life. They became homeless, and sometimes through their own choices, and there they were being rehabilitated, discipled into more responsible lives, and they would send these people to us because they knew we wouldn't judge them. We had people in the local pregnancy center who would, I remember getting that call one time from somebody who said, look, I want to refer somebody to you. She doesn't have much experience in religion. She's not a Christian. She's pregnant with her second child, a different father for each of them. She's not married. She's got a lot of tattoos. Can I send her to your church and know she won't be rejected? And I could say with honesty, yes, you can. She will be welcomed here. Got to baptize her some months later, and we got to have an impact in her life. So we looked at our values and saying, it's happening now. And if we were to take 200 people out and put them down somewhere else, which would be likely either way north of us or way south of us, it may not have the same character as the church. And if we daughter, that same kind of thing is true. And so we looked at our values and then we decided. We decided that right now, for the betterment of the ministry, we should expand where we are. And that was difficult. The city had issues with that, and it turns out so did the people from our church. We weren't feeling the crunch as much in the worship service, and so what ended up being approved was an expansion that would expand our children's ministry, and then we refurbished some of our area in our building for adult ministry, and we redid youth ministry center, and that's what we ended up doing. But there's the process. What do you do about growth? Here's the process. That's a good problem. Here's the process, looking at that process, whether you agree with it or not, with a real problem. Problem with staff. Define the problem. We had two part-time staff people, both of whom held very important positions in our church. One was our men's ministry director, and our men's ministry was thriving at that time. And he was married to our middle school director, and our middle school leader was just a fantastic leader, and the group had gone from zero to 70 in a matter of a few years. And incredibly popular with students, and popular with parents, popular with the volunteers who were there. And then they came to us and said, we're having marriage difficulties. And that's okay, we're a place of grace, right? And so we invested in them. We paid for them to go to an intervention. It took a whole weekend. They spent the weekend with counselors. They looked at all the issues that had brought them to where they were in their marriage, where it was difficult. It was a blended family. Each had been married before, had children from previous marriage, as well as children together. And looked at all of those forces, and we sent them there, and then we continued to pay our share in the cost for ongoing counseling for you and encourage them. And we kept in touch with them. We, who are leaders, sat with them regularly to pray for them and pray with them. And after all of that stuff, they decided to get divorced. The man left the church, went elsewhere. He didn't want to be part of us anymore, and he didn't want him to be part of the definition. They still loved each other. Didn't want his position to color what we might do with her. So the question became, what do we do with her? There are some possible answers. Well, we can fire her. We can say, you know, you violated the morality clause of our employment here. You've become somebody who's become a problem as we talk about people in the community and come here. We could fire you. We could suspend her from ministry for a period of time and maybe work toward a reconciliation between the two of them. Or could we restore her to ministry? We looked at the costs. We looked at what she was getting paid. We looked at what would happen if we had to dismiss her and get somebody in short term. We looked at the cost, not just that way, but we looked at the consequences. What would this do to the program? What would this do to the kids? Both ways. I mean, if we fired her, it was going to have a huge impact on kids who adored her. If we didn't fire her, there would be big questions on some parts of some people within the church who felt like we had to uphold morality in the church, that in a culture that is becoming less and less Christian in its orientation, we would be saying that, you know, morality isn't important. And so we looked at the consequences, and we looked at our values. And one of our huge values as a church, as I said, was grace. And so we talked a lot as elders. What is the grace response here to this situation? And we decided to restore her to ministry. We suspended her from active ministry for a period of time. She met with elders regularly during that time. We paid for counseling with a Christian counselor for her, and continued to ask her to accomplish some various tasks during that time of looking at what happened, meeting with some people who were offended, and then at the end of a period of time, we said, if things are going well, we will restore you to your position. As long as you exhibit repentance, as long as you exhibit repentance not just in words, but in a life that's choosing a different direction. Now, tough decision. Did we have people leave the church? Yes. Did the ministry get damaged? No. In fact, we were able to reaffirm again what it means to be a place of grace. Now, you may make a different decision. I just want to point out to you that this is the process that got us there. And I want to encourage you to work through the process, those six steps, in whatever you're facing. I would do it often with staff people who come, well, I got this problem. Okay, let's define the problem. You know, who's involved? How many people? What happened? Etc. What are the possible answers? What are the possible solutions to your problem? Estimate the cost. What are the consequences of each choice that you might make? And what values apply? And then make the decision and let the chips fall. You're going to find if you follow this, you're going to be making better decisions, and that will make you a better leader. Well, now I want to talk to you about developing some new skills as leaders. If you're a leader in one place for any significant time, period of time, it's going to require that you develop some new skills. Because as you lead toward the accomplishment of a vision, of a preferred future, you're going to find that what you need to do as a leader changes. For instance, here is it's a bell curve. It's a common bell curve. This bell curve is used to describe a variety of things, but this one describes the life cycle of an organization, and particularly the life cycle of a Christian organization. And what I want you to see is that we define these various steps and stages in the life cycle of an organization is that different skills are needed at each level. You can't just take the same skills and be as effective in each of these levels. So, for instance, we'll use the church as an example, since that's what I'm most familiar with. At launch, it's an exciting time for a church. You'll find that there's a leader that's passionate, that has given his life or her life to make this new venture happen. You'll find people who are sacrificing. In fact, resources will probably be in very short supply. Volunteers will be doing most of the work. There's not a staff to depend on usually, except in some unusual circumstances. And yet people are just excited and they're passionate. Anytime I've talked to people in the churches that I've served about how they began, I hear these great stories. And they look back at that time with love and joy in spite of the fact that it was tough. You know, both churches that I've served, the last two churches that I served, started out in rented facilities, and so they had to bring in everything. They brought in sound equipment, they brought in a stage, they brought in chairs, they brought in instruments. Every single Sunday they had to set up and tear down, set up and tear down. And yet when they look back at it, it was so exciting. And the last church I served bought an old building. It was a 100-year-old piano factory. And they look back, they had to work so hard getting part of that church ready so that they could use part of that building ready so that they could use it as a church. And yet those people were there till 2 a.m. sometimes, you know, scrubbing, cleaning, sandblasting old lead-based paint off columns, wood columns, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But nobody was complaining about that time. It was exciting. It was the launch. The momentum growth is the next stage. And that's when, okay, things are finally going and they start to roll. And because there's an excitement, a palpable excitement in an organization, that's a time when growth just seems to happen. Not just in churches, but in almost any Christian organization or any organization. Malcolm Gladwell is a business writer, writes about leadership from a business point of view, and he talks about the tipping point, you know, that all of a sudden things will take off if you can get this percentage of people into your program, and that they want that, even to the sale of hush puppies, and how hush puppies became, you know, such a big thing back when it was a big thing as shoes. So momentum growth happens. Then there's strategic growth. There comes a point where the momentum begins to slow and organization has to take place, or the momentum will fade entirely. Strategic growth is when you start putting down, you know, here are the departments, here are the responsibilities, here are the job descriptions, here are the salaries. Organization starts to come into play. And that enters a period of sustained health. As leadership works with management now to provide leadership and things get organized, there can be a period of sustained health. Then comes a day, usually in a church, that many times, for whatever reason, sometimes the neighborhood has changed, sometimes the community has changed, sometimes the church has changed, the pastor has changed. People will go into a maintenance mode. And that's where everything's happening in the church, but there's not many new people coming in. It's not growing anymore. In fact, the emphasis becomes more keeping people from leaving than emphasis about getting new customers in or new people in the church. And then there's the preservation stage where people look wistfully back at the past and remember when the church was full. And remember when, you know, they had these children's programs that were such big things. And they're trying to preserve the past. They're looking to the past more than they're looking toward the future. And then there's life support, where unless something is done soon, they're doomed to die. It's a life cycle. In the typical church in the United States, it takes about 100 years to do this cycle. In some places, in Southern California, the cycle moves much more quickly. It's about 50 years to run through that cycle. And so what I want to say to you is that whatever stage you're in that life cycle of a church, you're going to need certain skills. For instance, at the launch, you need an entrepreneurial leader. During that period of momentum, you need an entrepreneurial leader up until about the level of 200. If you've got 200 in church, in fact, it's been demonstrated over and over again that a common pattern in churches is that they go through that launch phase with excitement and energy and the resources sacrificially being supplied by the people, and they start growing and they get into momentum growth, and they hit about 200 in attendance at a worship service, and then something's got to change. Either that leader has to become somebody who is also a good manager in order to move on to strategic growth, or they've got to get somebody who's a good manager to move on into strategic growth, or the church will decline. Attendance will go down. And then they'll go through this cycle. It'll go back up to about 200, and it'll go down, back up to about 200, and go down. It's a cycle that's been repeated over and over again, and not just in the church. You know, most businesses that start in the United States last only about a year. And they'll go through this cycle of, you know, a launch, and there'll be advertising, and there'll be excitement, and then there'll be a momentum growth that everybody goes there to that restaurant or that coffee shop or that whatever. And then they get to that point where something's got to change, and it doesn't. And so they decline, and most businesses, as I said, that start are closed within a year. You need an entrepreneur, but then you need leadership, management leadership in particular, when you get to strategic growth. And then for sustained health, you really need management. You need somebody in leadership who's going to take care of the details, who's going to make sure that the management of the staff, the management of the resources, all of those things are taken care of, that the to-do lists are done. And then when you get to that maintenance section, that's where you really need a management skill. But when you get into preservation, you need leadership again. Because unless something changes dramatically, that church is going to die. And so they need somebody who can help them envision a new future. And when you're on the life support, you need the skills of a pastor, that you're able to care for people as you declare the death of the church. So that's, changes you're going to have to learn. Skills that you're going to have to develop at each stage. Or you're going to have to surround yourself with people who are able to do that. Now, it took me a long time to learn this. In the first church I served, I didn't know this stuff. And we went through, not a launch, but I came at the momentum phase. And we experienced a tremendous experience of growth. But I didn't get managers around me. And as a result, I left that church in a period of exhaustion, and it went right back down to the size it had been when I came. So the point is, you've got to learn to develop skills. You've shown that you're somebody who can do that just by being part of this class, as we talk about various skills and defining culture and defining vision and writing it down and rolling it out and all these subjects that are coming up in the future that we're going to be sharing in this course. You're somebody who's shown that you can do it. You've got to do it. Now, another skill I want to talk about briefly that you're going to have to develop and will help you is developing different skills in working with people, particularly with those who are on your staff or are your significant volunteers. I know sports illustrations or sport anecdotes are helpful to me. Some describe a company or a church when it's new, and the first staff person is another pastor, as two people walking down the golf course, right? You know, you're going golfing, and between the holes, you're either in the cart or you're walking together, and you're simply talking about life. Well, that describes, early on when a church or an organization is just beginning to grow, and you hire that first significant key position, and you're just these partners who are walking down the life together, journeying through that company together, and that's easy. But as the company grows, then you have to be thinking more on the lines of a basketball team. I lived in Southern California for a lot of years, so Lakers were always one of my favorite teams. But when you get to a basketball team, things get far more complex. First of all, you've got a point guard who's giving direction. You've got a shooting guard who is expected to shoot and take shots. You've got a center who's big. He's expected to get rebounds. He's expected to pass out. You've got forwards who are and expected to score as well as get rebounds. You've got all of these different roles. And in fact, now they talk about, you know, a strong forward and a small forward. And they further define these five roles. Now, when you get up to that point where you've added more employees and more partners into your ministry, the communication becomes exponentially more challenging. And so you've got to learn to define who's the leader. You know, Bill Hybels, for all that's happened with him, has been an incredibly effective leader. In his book, Church, he talks about the time when they got to this point where, you know, they were just a bunch of friends kind of walking along doing this ministry, high school ministry, and then creating a church out of it. And then came the time where he called the train wreck time, where they had to define roles. And, you know, obviously, he was going to be the leader. Well, some didn't like that, and so they left. But he was going to be the leader, and they defined roles. You're going to get to a point, if your ministry grows, to be an effective leader, that you're going to have to develop new skills in being that point person or finding somebody else who can do that more effectively than you and you taking a substitutionary role or a second seat in leadership. As an organization gets more complex, some have compared it to a football team. Now that's really complex because then you've got offense and defense and they never talk to each other, right? They don't consult with each other. They have meetings and the offensive people meet with the offensive coach and the defense meets with the defensive coach. And within that, you've got all these different roles to play. You know, you've got the lineman, you've got the quarterback, you've got the tailback, you've got the running back, you've got the wide receiver, you've got the tight end, you've got all of those different roles on offense and other ones similar on defense. And so all this maelstrom that happens, you've got to be a leader who learns to trust other leaders, who are going to develop other leaders, who develop other leaders. Now, and that takes a whole different set of skills than being on the golf course or on the basketball court. Now, you know, this is important. You know, I've learned about myself, much to my chagrin, that that was a jump that I was not able to make into the mega church category because I didn't have the skills. And I was able to lead a church up to about 1,000 people, and that's where it would level off. And I'm just saying to you, if you're going to grow as a leader, you're going to have to learn some different skills, and you're going to have to find out there are plenty of opportunities, leadership courses, leadership experiences all over the place. Learn to develop leadership, and you'll become a more effective leader. Now, the last one I put on there was the moving from shepherd to rancher. You know, in the church, I was trained as a shepherd. In other words, I was trained to know the sheep by name. I was trained to go to every sheep when they were injured. I was trained to carry every sheep that was tired or had a broken leg. And if a sheep was lost, I was the one who was supposed to go after them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I realized that a shepherd can only pastor a group of about 50 to 100 people. And so I had to become a rancher. And a rancher makes sure that people are fed and the lost sheep are found and make sure that that hurt people are cared for, but the rancher doesn't do it. He's got people who are responsible to do it. And that is a huge step. It's one of the steps that's been identified for churches, why they don't get over the hump of 200. 200 is the major barrier to further growth. And when they get to 200, things become more complex. And some of it's because the pastor can't take that step of saying, my job is not to be running around keeping all the sheep satisfied. My job is to raise up people who are going to take on the responsibilities of caring for these people while I become the rancher. So what do you do about that? We're going to talk about that further in this course. Study. There's a lot of study to do. Get a mentor. Get a mentor is very helpful. Get a leadership network going. You know, I've always found it helpful to speak with people who are further along in leadership than I. As I said, when I can create a network of those people, it has been a resource tremendously important to me. But as you develop as a leader where you are, what are you going to do when you all of a sudden become aware that your skills are no longer sufficient? That's the point of this class. How are you going to develop as a leader then? Be thinking about it now, and you'll be more effective in the future.